A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to this break from normal Film Trap tradition. We looked at what was out of the cinema. We were like, nah, we're like, rubbish.
Nothing interesting. I mean, I've heard that Capernaum is pretty good.
Looks bleak.
Yeah. And these are trying times, aren't they? It's a stressful period. I don't need any more trouble in my life.
So on this episode, we're going to try something new. We're going to do a retrospective review of 3 insect-based animation films, namely Ants, A Bug's Life, and
the classic,
the best movie of the three, a B movie. The reason for this is that over the course of Film Trap's history, I think we've taken a more political view of movies. I've been radicalized.
You've become a dangerous militant radical.
I've become a momentum thug. And, yeah. I tend to view movies through a lens I didn't used to before. And when I go back and watch movies I watched as a kid, I'm like, oh, this is interesting. The politics are sometimes suspect. And this is especially true of insect-based animations because the whole kids thing of basically giving any object or creature sentient human characteristics is more so in the insect movies because they have to deal with the society. So they have to take a view, and often these movies are about society changing. And so we thought it'd be fun to examine these movies with incisive intellectual rigor.
Yeah, it's like, it's interesting because the subject matter of anything that depicts the operation of a whole society is inherently political, but these aren't really films that have a political purpose.
No.
They just want to tell nice stories for kids. So I think it's in contrast in a way with something like Zootopia more recently, which definitely has a strong kind of political message that's quite explicit, and where the politics of it is, you know, was kind of intrinsic to the whole concept and making of the movie. Whereas in these films, any kind of political values that come out of it are basically sort of accidental or like, you know, side effect of their desire to just like make a fun like kids film.
Yeah.
But it's just unavoidable when you depict social realities. And also like they all depict economic structures as well, because yes, that's something that you also cannot get away from. With like insect, like insect worlds.
Exactly. So, welcome to the first episode of Childhood Cancelled. What's the working title? Start with Ants because it was released first. We're going in release order, and it narrowly beat Bug's Life to the box office, even though for a while they were competing. And there's a whole Wikipedia article if you want to really get into it about whether DreamWorks ripped off Pixar. Who knows? Anyway, the plot involves an ant colony and centers on Z, voiced by Woody Allen. He is an erotic and pessimistic worker ant who longs to express himself but finds the social order of the colony, where at birth you're either assigned to be a worker or a soldier, very stifling. Meanwhile, Bala, the princess of the colony, visits a bar to escape her suffocating royal life, and she meets Z and he falls in love with her. The ant colony then declares war on the encroaching termite colony, and a large force of soldier ants is mobilized for an attack. To see Bala again, Z exchanges places with his soldier friend Weaver and joins the army, where he befriends Barbatus, a staff sergeant voiced by Danny Glover in an explicit sort of black Vietnam vet reference. Z, however, is unaware that the army's leader and Bala's fiancé, General Mandible, is secretly sending the soldiers loyal to the Queen Ant to die so he can stage a coup. And in the ensuing battle of the termites, only Z survives. And before Barbatus dies, he tells Z to think for himself.
Don't make my mistake, kid. Don't follow orders your whole life. Think for yourself.
So Z then returns home and is hailed as a war hero. Secretly irate, Mandible congratulates him and introduces him to the Queen, where Bala is there and she recognizes him as the guy she danced with at the bar. Z panics and pretends to take Bala hostage, causing him and Bala to fall out of the anthill via a garbage chute. Z then decides to search for Insectopia, a legendary insect paradise, told to him by a raving drunk ant in a bar, and Bala begrudgingly goes along with him because she's afraid of the outside world. News of Z's escape spreads throughout the colony, and his act of individuality inspires the workers' ants and some of the soldiers to halt what they're doing and to start questioning society.
People, what is this, an encounter group? Let's get back to work.
Why?
To gain control, Mandible publicly portrays Z as a self-centered war criminal and promises the ants a better life when they complete a mega tunnel which they're all working on. However, Colonel Cutter, Mandible's second-in-command, becomes concerned with the General's actions. After various misadventures, Z and Bala find Insectopia, which is a human waste bin overfilled with decaying food, and Bala begins to crush on Z. That night, Cutter finds Bala and takes her forcibly back to the colony. Z pursues them. He rescues Bala, and after freeing her, she tells him that Mandible's mega-tunnel is in fact just an insane eugenics plan where he plans to tunnel through to a nearby puddle and thus drown all the worker ants. They try and stop this plan, but they don't arrive in time, and the worker ants are trapped in the center of the colony as the water slowly rises. To escape, Z organizes them to construct a huge ant ladder, and they get to the surface where the soldier ants are lined up. He breaks through.
Is that?
I think that's the weak element, sir.
Give me a hand.
See,
you let go. Don't you understand? It's for the good of the colony.
What are you saying? We are the colony.
Cutter revolts against Mandible. Mandible tries to kill Cutter by pushing him back into the colony, but Z pushes him out of the way. Both of them fall. Z lands in the water, but Mandible hits a root and dies. Cutter rescues. Classic end to a villain. You just hit a root, don't you? It just happens. Cutter rescues Z, and he's hailed a hero. And in the sort of closing epilogue, Z has married Bala, and he says they rebuilt the colony, and he's basically ended up where he started, but this time, he chose it. What does it mean, politically, though?
Well, I think, like, first thing to note about ants is that it's got a very self-consciously kind of more sort of adult-oriented script than A Bug's Life does. Yeah. So, they, I mean, it's hard not to compare these two directly because they both came out in the same year, like only a month apart. And because Ants is kind of a send-up of a Woody Allen-type character, it's sort of filled with these touches which are kind of for the grown-ups.
Yeah.
And so that makes the movie seem more explicitly political because it's full of references to real-life politics. The reference to the attack on the termite colony being a preemptive strike is clearly some kind of reference to, like, U.S. foreign policy. It seems to be a kind of criticism of that and, like, pointless U.S. wars. I mean, if it had been made a bit later, it would definitely seem like a comment on the Iraq War in 2003, but maybe it's, like, a comment on the first Gulf War. And when there's this kind of brief, like, workers' revolution moment, there's, like, an ant who says something like, the workers control the means of production.
You're telling me I don't have to be here?
We got a choice?
The authorities don't want you to know about it, but we don't have to work on the tunnel anymore.
It's the workers who control the means of production.
Z don't dig, I don't dig.
You know, so it's full of all this stuff, which, like, gives it this sort of political bent superficially. But I don't think it has a particularly coherent political message, mainly because the essential status quo of ant society is not particularly disturbed by the events of the movie. And it's much more a kind of story about one person attempting to express their individuality.
Yeah, when I first, well, rewatching it kind of changed my opinion on it, but at the beginning of the movie, there's a sort of sequence where all the ant workers form a giant wrecking ball in a very like overt metaphor that he is literally
a tool
of the state. And he like has open contempt for just like working to this state, which doesn't really reflect the needs of the people.
Yeah.
And then at the end, they build another structure, which is a big ladder where everyone is working to a collective good, which is not dying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So like they are working for each other. And then the General Mandible's plan of killing what he deems to be the weaker ants for a stronger colony was a critique of the society as a whole, where if you have a society where you think these people are more important than these people, the end result of that is kind of eugenics, like where certain life ceases to have value because of whatever bizarre...
Well, he's a kind of like social Darwinist, isn't he, really?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But they defeat his plan through socialism. I kind of read that.
Well, yeah, through a kind of collective effort.
Yeah.
I guess. But I think, like, it doesn't really... I wouldn't describe it as a really kind of socialist message, because the sort of opposition of it is not so much as between, like, a capitalist system and a socialist kind of emancipatory moment, but it's more like a totalitarian Soviet-style dictatorship, which is resisted by an act of individuality. And the key thing that you would expect to see in a socialist revolution is a upheaval of the economic order and a replacement of one system with another one. Whereas what we see in Ants is more like the deposition of an evil general and then things returning to normal.
Yeah.
Which pretty much explicitly like is how the film ends. And like all of the concerns that Z had at the beginning about his life are really ameliorated by his personal self-advancement rather than by a social change, which puts him in a better situation. Everyone's either a worker or a soldier still, but now he's married to a princess and he's just like, I guess he feels like he's accomplished something by his actions. So he probably just feels more sort of less neurotic now, I guess. You know, I mean, if they ever make an Ants 2, we'll find out if he's still miserable about being a worker. But yeah. So I didn't for that reason. I question how socialist the kind of moment of working together is at the end. I mean, also because the revolution that precedes it is kind of a bit of a joke that's like blown off by one speech from Mandible. So there's not really a suggestion that the workers have developed a sort of consciousness that enables them to overthrow their masters. They just sort of act together in a moment of self-preservation, which is nice to see, but I don't think represents that sort of revolution.
Yeah. One bit I did enjoy, which I thought was like an overtly good bit of a social commentary, is on their journey to Insectopia, they come across like a picnic and meet these two sort of posh wasps.
Darling, they're poor, they're dirty, they're smelly. We have to help them. If you'll just wait right here, we'll get you a little something.
No, please, Muffy, not another crusade.
Chippy, we have a social obligation to the less fortunate. I know you laugh at my hobbies, but this is important to me.
You have such a big heart.
Kind of like mockery of like Victorian charity or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. In that,
philanthropists.
Like, they're like rich and they view them with absolute contempt, but they're like full of pity and like, oh, you poor little things.
Yeah.
And they
yeah.
think they're so nice, but they're just, they're part of the system, man.
They're snobs.
They're snobs.
Yeah.
I did enjoy that bit.
That was funny.
I liked it as well. You know, one of the wasps die.
Yeah.
She deserved that for her attitude towards the lower classes.
Her patronizing attitude towards the working class.
But would you say that the message of the movie is basically to think for yourself? The revolt kind of comes about because people just start to question things, and Z is like constantly questioning the social order.
I think
which
like,
maybe makes the ending all the more disappointing, because that's just the same.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that's sort of precisely the limitation of that kind of think for yourself moral. I think it's a confusion that is quite fundamental, really, because thinking for yourself is not going to affect the rest of the world. It's just about like you yourself finding a more kind of fulfilling personal attitude. And I think the movie is much more comfortable with that sort of thing. But because it's depicting an entire society and these changes that affect, you know, the millions of ants in the colony, it kind of then has to address what would happen if like everybody started thinking for themselves. But then it doesn't follow through on that, because it's just, that's too big of a problem basically to deal with. So it just kind of like doesn't address it whatsoever. I mean, this movie is made in the late 90s when like it was at a very low ebb for like left-wing politics.
Yeah.
And
well, politics had been fixed by then, right? It was fixed.
Politics was fixed. Well, that was the end of history, and all the problems had been solved. You know, I mean, and then the central kind of political contrast that existed was between sort of Western democratic society, which is like the good society, and then the kind of Soviet gray world, which is, you know, the communist dictatorship. This is like the bad society. And the movie cannot really like grapple with like a kind of violent overthrow that transforms one form of society into another one, because that's like a method of political change that it's, you know, is sort of too radical to basically be addressed. It's only really that the personal transformation of yourself is the only thing that it can really deal with.
Yeah. Do you think if Ants just like the last 5 minutes showed like a really cool society, it's just like the last 2 minutes just let it down?
Yeah, shows them like electing their representatives or something like that.
Ant Wakanda, you know, like, right
at
the end.
Yeah,
with a democratic election process.
Well, they basically
all the ants are painting and like doing art and writing books.
Yeah, they're all expressing themselves, and they've all got weekends now and
like
stuff. They got
commune.
Yeah, they got labor rights and yes, yeah. I think that's exactly what it should have done. It should have shown them all basically going off, carting the garbage can into the hive, and then living high on the hog while they, you know, enjoy a life of leisure, and implement a perfect post-work society.
My favorite film stars Bridget Bardot. She's the queen, and she wants to be in radio. So she starts a podcast with her friends, and the terrorists try to stop her, but she beats them in the end.
Bug's Life. What can I say about Bug's Life?
What can one say? What can one say about what happens in the plot?
So, A Bug's Life. So, Ant Island is a colony of ants led by the queen and her daughter, Princess Atta. And every season, they are forced to give food to a gang of marauding grasshoppers led by the imaginatively named Hopper. He's a grasshopper called Hopper.
He hops.
Voiced by Kevin Spacey. No animation is complete without some sort of disgraced actor who was big in the 90s. One day, the hero Flick, an individualist and would-be inventor, inadvertently knocks the offering into a stream with his latest invention, a grain harvesting device. In retaliation, Hopper demands twice as much food as compensation by the end of summer. When Flick suggests in earnest that they seek help from other stronger bugs, the other ants see as an opportunity to remove him and send him off on his quest, even though they think it's bullshit. At the Bug City, which is just a heap of trash under a trailer, Flick mistakes a troop of circus bugs for warriors. And in return, the bugs think he is a talent agent and accept his offer to travel back with him to Ant Island. During the welcome ceremony upon their arrival, the circus bugs and Flick both discover their mutual misunderstandings, but eventually the circus bugs decide to stay and continue the ruse of them as warriors to help Flick with his plan, which is to construct a false bird out of leaves and twigs to scare away the grasshoppers. Meanwhile, Hopper tells his gang how greatly the ants outnumber them and worries that they will eventually rebel against them unless they crack the whip and keep them subdued. The ants finish constructing the fake bird, but Flick and the circus performer's deception is revealed and they are exiled. And when Hopper returns to discover the mediocre offering the ants could muster, he takes over the island and demands their winter food supply and plans to assassinate the queen afterwards. Overhearing the plan, Atta's younger sister Dot goes after Flick and the circus bugs, and they decide to return to save the ants. The circus bugs try and distract the grasshoppers doing some of their circusing. That's what they're circus bugs is what they do. And Flick deploys the bird, but it is not successful. Hopper beats Flick in retaliation, saying that the ants are humble and lowly life forms who live to serve the grasshoppers. However, Flick responds that Hopper actually fears the colony because he's always known that the ants are in fact stronger. This inspires the ants to basically overthrow the grasshoppers and kick them off the island. And in the epilogue scene, Flick's inventions have been embraced by the colony, and basically everything is great.
Delightful.
So, yeah, much clearer the have and have nots sort of message to it.
It's quite a nice parable of class struggle.
They're literally the 1%.
They're literally the 1%.
There's a bit where he says they outnumber us 100-1. They are the many, we are the few.
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100-1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
Almost all of the wealth and much of the income is going to the top 1%.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a story about owners and producers. The workers get all the food and they're not allowed to keep it. It's just taken from them by the grasshoppers. And they learn that they don't need the owners. The workers can simply share the produce that they make amongst themselves. And they outnumber this sort of bourgeois grasshoppers and they just kick them out. And I think it's like, politically speaking, it's pretty strong.
I would say this though, to play devil's avocado.
Go ahead.
It's implied that there's tons and tons of grain and they can basically collect enough grain for themselves and the grasshoppers. And if they didn't have the grasshoppers, they'd have to like work an hour a day or something, you know, just because it doesn't take that much time.
Yeah.
It's just the extra burden of the grasshoppers. But because there are grasshoppers, it causes Flick to come up with this brilliant grain collecting invention.
Flick, what are you doing?
Oh, this! This is my new idea for harvesting grain. No more picking individual kernels. You can just cut down the entire stalk.
Flick, we don't have time for this.
Exactly! We never have time to collect food for ourselves because we spend all summer harvesting for the offering. But my invention will speed up production.
So the free market, Sam.
Yeah, I mean...
Progress.
I think, yeah. Well, I mean, there's no currency or market or competition.
I'm just
competition.
Saying, if the grasshoppers went around, would have invented that brilliant grain collecting thing for which, for some reason, the society rejects, even though it's clearly incredibly efficient?
Yeah, I guess that's true. The pressures of society drove innovation for Flick. Although I would say that the way he's depicted in the movie suggests that it's just the outcome of his own kind of character rather than the result of like the necessity of having to find a way to do it more efficiently.
Well, the society as it's portrayed at the beginning is they're basically kind of like Amish or something, right? They just sort of reject. They have like
they're very conservative,
ways.
Yeah. They're also kind of like idiots. I mean, there's the moment at the beginning where like there's an ant who just can't get around a leaf.
Yeah.
He just doesn't know what to do with like a leaf in the way. So they're kind of dumb. I think it's another, this is something that Bug's Life shares with ants as well, which I think is a sort of trap that a film of this nature finds it easy to fall into, which is like a depiction of the people or of like a group in society easily slides into, you know, the people are actually, they're all kind of dumb.
Yeah.
And that your hero is distinguished from them because he can think for himself and he's smart and everyone else is just, they're actually quite happy. I think this is a problem that Ants has actually, not to like backtrack too much, but like Z's dissatisfaction with the oppressive society in which he lives is the outcome of his own personal neurosis and it's not the outcome of like actually oppressive conditions.
Yeah, it's very true.
And like everyone else is kind of very fine with it. Weaver is very happy being a soldier and he's even happier being a worker. And you know, Azteca seems to be also perfectly fine. And when there's like a scene in the bar where they all do a dance, they're kind of line dancing, and Z is like does an individual different dance because he's a, you know, free thinker, but they're kind of cool. Like they don't, yeah. No one else seems really upset. So as a depiction of oppression, it's not especially successful. And in A Bug's Life, the oppression is of a very different character, but I still think it has this view of like just the mass of people as basically not very interesting. You know, it takes one person who's got something different and unique to actually be of interest and of value. Whereas, like, yeah. Most people are just kind of dumb. They just, like, go about their stupid lives. They don't question anything, and they're not really worth thinking about. You know, I think that's the kind of... There's a bit of an underlying attitude of, like, mistrust of what people will do if you actually let them...
Yeah,
So, I mean, the mechanisms which are too democratic can be a bit concerning because you don't know what people are going to come up with, you know? So I think it's in some ways, like, often easier to depict changes, like... just coming from like the one guy who had the great idea and then everyone else was like, hey, yeah, I get on board with that. So
the other thing like is that none of these movies really go into much detail about how society totally works because they're all in reality based around queens. There's like kind of, there's a royal council, but it's like the queen is in charge, but she's just one ant and she's only basically just overseeing what they have to do anyway.
Yeah.
So it seems like a pretty flat power structure.
Yeah, like within ant society, they have this, it's obviously hierarchical because you have the royal family at the top.
But like there's royal family and then there's just everybody else. There's no like lords or...
Yeah.
You can't accumulate wealth as an ant.
Yeah.
So there's only a title.
Yeah, I think And also because it's like just like a biological reality that some of them are different. You know, the she has a key kind of role to play. She's also a worker in a way. You know,
yeah, exactly.
She has her thing that she has to do, which
she's
is like
fucking queen,
give birth to a lot of ants.
Get out there and do some cleaning.
Yeah, not like human monarchs.
Yeah.
Who don't do anything. I mean, she has to, you know, cut ribbons and do that speech every year. But other than that, you know, is not contributing. But yeah, but I think that's a good thing about the depiction of the Amoeba. It is sort of relatively horizontal, basically. Just because there's this clear other class, which is the grasshoppers, who lie above them.
Well, I guess it's like basically the only thing wrong with society is the grasshoppers. At the end, they're gone. So it's fine.
Yeah, but I think that's like a solid story, you know? That's exactly the way that these kinds of animal fables should work. There's a problem, and there's a solution. And the solution teaches you a moral about the world, which in this case is don't let people take your own stuff from you. There's a collective good. Everyone works for it, and everyone should share in the wealth that results. And if people just come and take the shit from you, that's unjust, and it shouldn't be allowed. I mean, that's a good solid moral.
Let this be a lesson to all you ants. Ideas are very dangerous things. You are mindless, soil-shoving losers. Put on this earth to serve us.
You're wrong, Hopper. Ants are not meant to serve grasshoppers. I've seen these ants do great things. And year after year, they somehow manage to pick food for themselves and you. So who is the weaker species? Ants don't serve grasshoppers. It's you who need us. We're a lot stronger than you say we are. And you know it, don't you?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When Zach Braff heard something that changed his life, what he listened to?
Filmchart.
When John Cusack made a mixtape for his future wife, what did she listen to? And when Michael Madsen cut a guy's ear off, what was he dancing to?
Filmchart.
And when Tim Robbins showed Shawshank that he had enough, which record did he choose?
Filmchart.
Yeah.
I will now describe the story of B-Movie, a completely conventional and normal film. You always be able to predict what happens next.
Yeah.
So it's about a young honeybee named Barry B. Benson, voiced by Jerry Seinfeld, who has graduated from college, is about to enter his Hive's workforce, which is like a company called Honex Industries that makes all the honey, which basically everyone belongs to, alongside his best friend Adam, who's voiced by Matthew Broderick. He's initially excited to join Honex Industries, but he is disappointed to discover that he will have his job for life, and he's, you know, a bit more nonconformist than this. He runs into a bunch of pollen jocks who are the sort of muscular alpha male bees who go outside the hive and pollinate flowers. He joins them for a ride because he doesn't want to do whatever boring job he have in the hive. Out in the world, he is caught in a rainstorm and separated from the rest of the pollen jocks, and ends up on the balcony of a human called Vanessa in New York City. Vanessa's boyfriend Ken attempts to kill Barry, but Vanessa, who is voiced by Renee Zellweger, gently catches and rescues him and saves his life. Barry is forced by his gratitude to go and thank Vanessa, thereby breaking the sacred bee law that bees are not supposed to communicate with humans. Barry and Vanessa become friends and develop a bond. It's sort of close to romantic. And when they're on a sort of bee human date at the supermarket, Barry is horrified to find honey being sold at the supermarket, which has been stolen from the bees, in his opinion. And he tracks the honey down to its source at a place called Honey Farms, which supplies the grocery store, and discovers that bees are in kinds of concentration camps in there, in sort of weird motel rooms, being subdued by the use of bee smokers. And Barry is horrified by this and decides to sue the human race in order to put an end to the exploitation of bees. Barry's launch of a legal challenge to all humans is sort of goes ahead and attracts a lot of media attention. And Barry and his bee friends rock up at courts to face down Leighton T. Montgomery, a kind of evil southern attorney voiced by John Goodman. The first day of the trial goes quite well. On the second day, Montgomery launches a bee character assassination about how evil bees are, thus provoking Barry's friend Adam to sting him. Montgomery makes a huge deal out of being stung, thus making bees look bad, like deadly, and Adam is severely injured by the sting. Barry visits him in hospital and expresses, you know, his happiness that Adam has not died, and they have a sudden realization when he notices two smokers outside the window. The next day, Barry goes into the trial and uses the existence of the bee smokers as a way to gather sympathy for the bee people because of how much exploitation there is, and this ends up winning the trial. As a result, humans have to return all of their honey to bees.
Of course.
Bees then have so much honey they don't need to make it anymore, and it puts all the bees out of a job. So they're just indolent now, and they're kind of miserable as a result, so things weren't so great. It also causes all the flowers in the world to die, except for in one place, which is a parade in Pasadena called the Tournament of Roses. And Barry, who's feeling rather guilty about his actions, decides to enlist Vanessa's help to go and fetch the flowers in Pasadena and return them to New York so that all of the flowers can be repollinated. They go there, they successfully steal the flowers, they put them on the plane, but while on the plane, trouble breaks out when both the pilot and co-pilot knock each other out upon seeing Barry in a sort of odd turn of events. And without anyone flying the plane, it's going to crash. So Barry and Vanessa have to work together to land the plane. And loads of bees attach themselves to the plane's wings and help land it.
Duh.
Oh, and so everyone is saved. They take the flowers from the plane, repollinate everything. Everything kind of goes back to normal, except now bee-approved honey is sold in stores. So the exploitative situation from before has been improved. And Barry has become a pollen jock, and he's also a lawyer working at a law firm inside Vanessa's flower shop called Insects at Law, handling disputes between humans and animals. Beautiful.
Incredible.
Perfect film.
Lot to unpack.
Lot to unpack. I mean, it's a very stream of consciousness style plot, which like moves from one thing to another constantly with very little regard for coherence.
Yeah, I guess one angle of it is that Barry realizes that bee slavery is happening, and Lincoln style,
he's emancipates
the bees.
Yeah,
because they're working in these bee houses,
but with, for some reason, dire consequences.
But as we all know, when we stop slavery,
it was an economic disaster.
It was an economic disaster, wasn't it? Really?
Yeah.
So on one hand, slavery bad, good to stop it, but it's got this rapacious capitalist sort of message where life without any kind of work is meaningless.
Is hell.
Adam, you wouldn't believe how much honey was out there.
Oh, yeah?
What's going on around here? Where is everybody? Are they out celebrating?
No, they're just home. They don't know what to do. They're laying out. They're sleeping in. I heard your Uncle Carl was on his way to San Antonio with a cricket.
At least we got our honey back.
Yeah, but sometimes I think, so what if the humans liked our honey? Who wouldn't? It's the greatest thing in the world. I was excited to be a part of making it. This was my new desk. This was my new job. I wanted to do it really well. And now I can't.
You know, the workless society of leisure where you can do whatever you want and you're not trapped in the kind of, you know, this like corporate system, which is depicted at the beginning of the film as very stifling. You know, is then later shown to be awful, and in fact that was a paradise.
Yeah, it's also a case where nothing is particularly clear in this film, but from as much as you can deduce, the sort of state and business is exactly the same. Like, yeah. He works for Hunex Industries, which is like a sort of subsidiary of like the Hexagon Group. But that seems to be also the government. So everyone works for the same company. And as such, no wonder they get depressed, because there's literally no other society other than work.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a line where, because of the sort of Dr. Seuss-like world, he says,
"Woo-hoo! I love this incorporating the amusement park right into our regular day.
I guess that's why they say we don't need vacations."
And then later, in a brilliant scene between him and Kevin, he mentions that bees have 100% employment rate. So you just work every day, you never get time off, then you die. That's bad, but when you do get time off, that's even worse. Seems to be the message.
Yeah, basically.
And then at the end, everything is returned to normal. But the only difference is they're somehow getting recompense for their honey. But given that honey is the currency, it's not entirely clear.
I honestly am not sure. Like, I think it's really unclear what exactly the role is of honey in like their bee society, because it's so kind of universal. I mean, even when Adam injures himself, he's getting honey through an IV drip. So it's like a medical thing as well. Like,
it's like blood. It's blood, it's money, it's hair gel, it's water.
It's just everything.
If you cut open a bee, just honey spills out. What it does have going for it, I think, which is something it doesn't really investigate, but just a byproduct of how like haphazardly put together the film is that it kind of makes the point that if the bees are fully sentient and have a sort of, you know, capable of speech and are as smart as humans, then obviously they should not have their honey taken. They should be protected by the same human rights as a human.
Wait!
Don't kill him!
You know I'm allergic to them! This thing could kill me!
Why does his life have any less value than yours?
Why does his life have any less value than mine? Is that your statement?
I'm just saying all life has value. You don't know what he's capable of feeling.
But it gets incredibly strange at the end when he's a lawyer and he's like interviewing a cow who's like complaining about her milk being taken. It's like, so if every single animal on the planet is as smart as a human, like what the hell is going on? But
it's against the cow law.
It's the cow law.
The cows can't talk.
So in that way, it's quite right on. It's the same way like in the world of Toy Story, the toys are alive, but they're being treated badly all the time just because humans are unaware. They just think they're objects.
Yeah, I mean, it does work. It functions almost as a kind of parody of, or like a send-up of the whole concept of applying human-like characteristics to non-humans.
Yeah.
You know, it takes it to this absurd extreme, which basically, it feels like if there's any message, it's like bees are not like people, and it would make no sense if they were, and this is the kind of madness, the result, if we start to posit this as a possibility.
So the basic, again, harder to deduce what Seinfeld is trying to say, but he seems sort of like keen on the whole capitalist model.
It's another story about individualism, isn't it, really? It's kind of like, I think if so, insofar as there's any message whatsoever, it's not all that different to Ants, in that it's about a guy who's, you know, feels different to everyone around him and is looking for a way to express himself. And the biggest change that occurs in the movie is his lot in life, from being stuck working for Hunnix Industries in whatever boring role to getting to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
Whereas all of his boring friends who have no ambitions whatsoever get their dead end jobs and they're all happy.
Yeah. It's not clear if there was any lawyers before this court case. There was no cause for a bee lawyer.
No, he's,
even though there's many bee laws.
Well, he's created a job and then filled it. You know, he's created his own niche. He's a job creator. Yeah, exactly.
So Seinfeld's perfect world is one where people just get paid for their labor.
Yeah, he seems to be. Yeah, exactly. he likes being rich.
This B movie basically just like Seinfeld discovering that Pirate Bay exists. Oh, my DVDs are being sold! And then he takes Pirate Bay to court and gets them to take down their torrents, but then society crumbles because nobody can afford to watch his seminal 90s sitcom. So he's forced.
Well, that's the other thing that's messed up about the movie is that it presents a property rights issue as a kind of like human rights issue or bee rights. I mean, his central complaint is property rights, but that's clearly not as bad.
Slavery is the secondary to you.
It's just the narrative that he uses to get the property. rather than being the central actual bad thing.
That's his like eureka moment. It's like, oh, that's the way to win them over.
Yeah.
Slavery bad.
Yeah, exactly. Rather than like that having been what horrified him in the first place.
Members of the jury, look at what has happened to bees who have never been asked, smoking or none. Is this what nature intended for us? To be forcibly addicted to these smoke machines in man-made wooden slat work camps? Living out our lives as honey slaves to the white man?
So, I don't know. There's a gaping moral void at the heart of Bee Movie. It's just a complete mess.
If we could combine the funny humor of Ants with the right on message of Bug's Life and the incredible vocal performance of Bee Movie, that, my friend,
yeah,
would be a film for the ages.
Just starring Seinfeld. Seinfeld with Bee Movie, the only one with a non-problematic cast.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say, like, you know, if I was summarizing what we've learned from this discussion, I think that the more sort of straightforward and fable-like tale that's told in A Bug's Life is the most kind of successful way to do this, because it does not really attempt to construct an entire social reality in the way that Ants does sort of gesture towards, and B-Movie does as well. And it just instead presents a single social dynamic, an injustice, and a mechanism for resolving it and leading to a better society. And I think that's, you know, quite an effective way to tackle this. Whereas Ants and B-Movie are both films with, as far as you can discern a message, something about individualism and free expression, but then also a context which depicts the operation of a whole society. And I think that creates a sort of confusion that the movies do not successfully resolve. So I think that's, you know, that if I was making a film about a society of animals who act like humans, you know, I would think I would go more down the Bug's Life route. What do you reckon?
Yeah, but I think it needs to be more radical.
But more radical.
They need to kill the queen as well.
Yeah.
They need to get rid of any kind of monarchy.
Yeah.
The power structure needs to be completely flat by the end. It's like, no one put you in charge. We're having elections from now on.
They need to institute some radical democracy.
Yeah, exactly.
That is part of a problem. Yeah.
Time for a break from all the film chat. Have a cup of tea, maybe make a quick snack, and telephone a friend so you know where she's at. Right, that's enough, now back to film chat.
I hope that this departure from the regular kind of format has been welcome. I don't know, it's a bit of an experiment for us. So, you know, who knows if it worked or not.
Who knows?
But maybe we'll try it again. I mean, after 180 plus episodes, sometimes you got to shake things up a little bit.
It's like a marriage going stale, you know. Sometimes you've got to just buy some edible chocolate and pretend to be a sailor on leave or whatever people do in loveless marriages.
Yeah, we've got that 188 episode itch.
It needs to be scratched.
All right, so we'll be back on the normal bullshit next week, I think.
Yeah.
I'm sure some stuff will have come out by then.
That Rebel Wilson rom-com Netflix movie.
Can't wait to get my teeth into that one.
I think, yeah.
Absolutely.
What does that say about society?
Yeah, and I want to spend a good 15 or 20 minutes talking about The Umbrella Academy, which I watched.
Yeah, is that good?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. I kind of enjoyed it. It's got like a kind of chimp butler character, so I enjoyed that aspect of it.
Nice.
All right, friends. Thank you for tuning in, listening to us talking at length about insects, animated insects and their lives. And we'll see you next time.
Toodaloo.
Bye.
We heard from many sources when the movie started rolling out that audiences were applauding at the end. And it came from a few different sources of people that were going to theaters, and that was, for me, the most satisfying, and I think will always be the most satisfying thing. It's not how many people went or who went or reviews and things like that, just that the people that went had a good time. And that was really the only object.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.